they're not going to call you, but if you reach out and give them that.
Yeah, that little nudge.
Yeah. Excellent.
Number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. It is a great and important day for the Republic. It is a day that is actually alluded to in the Constitution of the United States. I mean, not today by date, not March 7th of 2024. But the idea of the President of the United States fulfilling his constitutional obligation to give a report about the State of the Union. And one of the key questions, and this was raised by Elise Stefanik, who is one of the most open Republicans in terms of campaigning for the vice presidency. She is really, really going for it. My email is completely flooded by what they call Team Elise material from Stefanik. She has raised the question that I believe that President Biden should address, which is the question is, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And, of course, her answer is a decisive no. There's another answer that's provided by Jonathan Last over at The Bulwark. And from a conservative point of view, saying that actually the question about whether America is better off is very clearly, yes, we are, in terms of a crime rate, in terms of the economy, in terms of unemployment. And simply in terms of maybe, just maybe, getting things done, they have made steps. And congratulations to Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. They have made some real progress in moving us away from another government shutdown threat, which was supposed to hit us tomorrow if they hadn't taken action, which they had. And this is actually longer-term action that may postpone a government shutdown threat, may postpone that not just for another week, but maybe for an entire fiscal year. What are we finding out about the presidential address tonight, the State of the Union address? The New York Times is reporting that 20 guests will join Jill Biden to watch the State of the Union address from the First Lady's viewing box in the House chamber tonight. This is a lineup that is set to draw sharp distinctions with Republicans as President Biden seeks to highlight his achievements and to press his advantage on issues like reproductive rights. Most striking element about this guest list is that one of the things that all of the experts are writing about that is a problem for Biden, and one of the reasons that there is a generally growing feeling that President Trump is the likely winner of the election in November, one of the four big reasons that the New York Times even writes about that in an analysis by Shane Goldmacher, is they talk about the split in the Democratic Party with so many Democratic constituencies, particularly young people, particularly people of color, who do not appreciate the president's support of the State of Israel in this moment after the attack of October 7th brought Israel to war against the terrorists in Hamas. It's striking that President Biden is not running away from that. He is planned to announce tonight some progress in providing humanitarian aid to reach the victims of the war in Gaza, the civilian victims of the war in Gaza. And some of these plans apparently are pretty substantial, involving building a new port in Gaza and using military resources to do that, that can help the aid be more reliably delivered. But also sitting there in the guest box will be some family members of some of the hostages that the United States is still working to try to get released. And of course, Hamas has been extremely uncooperative and unwilling to release those hostages, even in exchange for a six-week ceasefire, which everybody seems to want, and as well the release of some Palestinian prisoners who were not taken randomly as hostages. They are people who were arrested and tried and imprisoned, but they would be released under some kind of hostage plan if they made progress on that. That progress has not been made. The president is battling an approval rating, which is down in Jimmy Carter territory. It's even worse than Trump's approval rating was when he was facing his last State of the Union address. And who knows, it could be just a prelude to four more State of the Union addresses that he has with a second term, or it could be his last ever. But the 38.1% approval rating is not a great situation for President Biden. What is a great situation for President Biden is the speculation is that nobody is going to pay attention to the Republican response to this address. That response is going to be delivered by Senator Katie Britt of Alabama. And of course, the only way that Alabama has been in the news recently is with that disastrous court decision that basically required that the law treat fertilized embryos that were frozen as part of IVF treatment, in vitro fertilization. And very, very unpopular. And the governor of Alabama, Governor Ivey, has just now signed a new bill that was meant to protect the availability of in vitro fertilization in Alabama. But why do you pick Katie Britt, who is a brand new senator? She's only been in the Senate for 2 years. She was elected in 2022. And why do you pick her above any of the other well-known Republicans? Is it just because people don't have anything against her so far? I'm sure she will make a good impression on television. She's an attractive person. But really, why not use this opportunity to try to unite the party? Katie Britt is also somebody who has been close to President Trump and definitely sees herself as part of the MAGA wing of the party. Last year, you may remember the speech answering the State of the Union address by President Biden was provided last year at approximately this time by Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the newly elected governor of Arkansas. And given the fact that the Republican Party is already very strong in Arkansas, it's very strong in Alabama, it's very strong in the South generally, the idea that they could have gone to someone representing one of the perennial swing states, like Wisconsin, or for that matter, Michigan, or for that matter, Pennsylvania, which is right now is the only one of the swing states where Biden has a slight lead. Meanwhile, the GOP could have, as Jeremy Steiner, pride of Hillsdale College, suggests, actually had someone who would really very much help in unifying the party if she had gotten that role of answering the President of the United States, Joe Biden, after the State of the Union address. Who would that selection be? We'll get to it coming up on The Medved Show.
Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, we're talking about the choice of the very little-known Senator Katie Britt, who was just elected 2 years ago as a senator from Alabama. She is one of the lesser-known members of the U.S. Senate. She just hasn't been there very long. Barack Obama was a celebrity from the very first day he came to the Senate. Why? Because he had given a famous speech at the Republican convention in 2004. The Democrat convention, of course. Yeah, Barack Obama was not invited to speak at a Republican convention. But in terms of inviting someone to speak for the Republican Party to give an answer to the State of the Union address, Jeremy Steiner, Pride of Hillsdale College, suggests, and I think it's an intriguing idea, is why not the woman of the hour, Nikki Haley? She would, of course, have to, before she gave the address answering Biden, she would have to formally endorse President Trump, as she once upon a time, a long time ago, promised she would do, assuming that he is, in fact, the winner of the nomination. And yes, by the way, I think there are a lot of people who supported Nikki Haley who would be uncomfortable at her coming over so quickly and right away to speak on Trump's behalf. But if she would, think how much it would help the Republican Party and the Republican cause. There's a Wall Street Journal lead editorial today which says what Nikki Haley accomplished. And one thing she accomplished is she won 763,763 votes. Now, yes, she voted. She won about half the votes that Trump did. So Trump won very decisively. However, those are votes that Trump needs, because one of the points that Mark Thiessen, who is a pro-Trump conservative Republican, columnist for The Washington Post, one of the points he makes is that the issue facing Trump is not never Trump voters who didn't support him in the past and won't vote for him now under any circumstances. And there are, by the way, millions of people like that. It is not Trump again voters. That's the problem for him, not Trump again. These are Americans who are open to his policies and might have voted for him before. They might have voted for him twice before. But they don't like how he behaved, particularly after the 2020 election, and they supported Haley in the primaries. The former group is unpersuadable. That would be the Never Trumpers. But the latter group, the ones who supported Haley in the primary, and that's again about a third of all Republicans, that might not be unpersuadable. But Trump, writes Mark Thiessen, former speechwriter to President Bush, Mark Thiessen writes, but Trump has to go out and persuade them. He needs to recognize that right now the party is not united. It is deeply divided between the dominant MAGA wing, which encompasses about two-thirds of Republican voters, and the not MAGA wing, which makes up about a third. Trump can't take back the presidency without bringing the not MAGA Republicans into his fold. But according to the Fox News voter analysis, 53% of not MAGA Republicans in Iowa, 57% in South Carolina, and 65% in New Hampshire say they will not vote for Trump in November. The issues that are helping Biden, at least potentially, that he is trying to make use of tonight. One of them is, and this, of course, is something we talked about yesterday. They are going to have someone representing Ukraine's struggle for survival and for independence. They had apparently formally invited Olena Zelenskaya, who is the wife, Zelenska is the way they say her last name in Russian. She is the wife of Volodymyr Zelensky. She turned down the invitation to come and to be part of that State of the Union guest group. But there will be someone representing the struggle for Ukraine. They will also have in the guest box the Prime Minister of Sweden. Now, why? Because he just joined NATO. And it's really, this is a feel-good story. It's one of the feel-good stories of all time because Sweden is a powerful country. It has a formidable military. It has a formidable economy. There is all kinds of reasons to be very positive toward the Scandinavian countries. Sweden is the most largest and substantial of them. Sorry, Norway. But in any event, the Prime Minister of Sweden will be there to celebrate his entrance into NATO. What does it have to do with the presidential race? President Trump has attacked NATO. And he has, in fact, basically hinted, he did during his first term, that he wants less U.S. involvement with NATO, even talking about leaving the NATO alliance. And foreign policy will play a role in the State of the Union address. Daniel Pletka, a distinguished senior fellow in foreign aid and defense policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute, has written a piece that notes one of the differences that we're going to hear very, very clearly between the State of the Union address of last year and the one we're going to hear tonight. Biden had been speaking for more than an hour by the time he got to foreign affairs issues at all. That was last year. Tonight, it seems to me that foreign affairs, and Daniel Pletka makes that point, are going to play a much more substantial role. And the guest list indicates that. There was another video that was released this morning where some of Biden's campaign team thought it would be a good idea to preview his upcoming speech by releasing a video. Well, it was released this morning. The video's not good. But it shows the President of the United States speaking to various actors and actresses who have played presidents on TV and in the movies. We will get to that, hearing the presidential insights, priceless, from Michael Douglas, Morgan Freeman, Bill Pullman, Gina Davis, and more. Daniel Pletka of American Enterprise Institute coming up on what to expect from the State of the Union and why we shouldn't fall for Hamas's numbers game. Coming up on The Medved Show.
There's a time where someone from the outside has to step in and take control.
Michael Medved. More of Michael Medved in a moment.
And on the Michael Medved Show, a pleasure to welcome back to the show Daniel Pletka, who is a distinguished senior fellow in foreign and defense policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute, where she focuses on U.S. foreign policy generally and the Middle East in particular. She also teaches concurrently at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service. She's written a couple of interesting pieces, one of which talks about what to expect in the State of the Union address tonight and how that will help to define the campaign that will be unfolding over the next 8 months. Danielle, you basically are guessing that President Biden is going to give a more prominent role to discussions about foreign policy this year than he did last year. Is that right?
Well, on the one hand, yes, and I hope so. You know, last year, we were in the first year of the Russian war on Ukraine. We were still looking at a much more dangerous Iranian nuclear program and, you know, everything else. China, we could go on for a while here. He didn't get to foreign policy at all until his second hour, and then devoted about two sentences to it. This year, I think he's probably going to do more, but I'm a little worried about what he's going to say.
Information from his handlers and from the Democratic Party is basically there will be some family members of hostages who are being held by Hamas in Gaza, and that he also will be making an announcement about building some kind of large military port to facilitate the importation of more emergency humanitarian supplies to keep Gazans alive. Do you think that will take a prominent place in the speech?
You know, I'm not sure. On the one hand, he has introduced this idea today that the United States military is going to be constructing, at the expense of the U.S. taxpayer, a port in Gaza. This sounds to me like a not brilliant idea made with politics in mind, as opposed to policy. I find it hard to believe that he would be so desperate, so worried about voters, as they keep signaling in Michigan, that they would give this pride of place. Especially given, as you rightly say, that there are going to be families of hostages who have been held for over 150 days by Hamas in Gaza, men, women, children, bodies. So, you know, again, it's a very tough call, and I'm not quite sure where he's going to do this.
Again, there there apparently are a bunch of guests he will he will have in the viewing box, together with Dr. Jill Biden, the First Lady. The Prime Minister of Sweden is going to be there to help celebrate Sweden's official, as of today, membership in NATO. Is that an important gesture to make? It seems to me it's basically trying to set up a contrast with the pro-NATO attitude of the Biden administration. That's very different from what you would hear from President Trump, isn't it?
Might be. You know, obviously, Sweden just acceded to NATO. They were just voted in. So it's a very nice celebration. It's a nice gesture. But let's also understand that Russia, the reason that Sweden joined NATO was because they were so worried about Russia. And the reason that Russia is so unleashed, that Putin feels so much impunity that he can, in fact, invade his neighbors and annex vast swaths of territory, is because he senses the weakness of this administration. And so, yes, that might be a message, but I think it's a very, very risky line to take. I also think that, frankly, the president of the United States is the president of the United States, not the president of the Democratic Party. And it drives me crazy as a Washington denizen of many years when Republicans or Democrats take that office, that White House office and that State of the Union, and use it to score political points against their opponents. That's not the right way to use this speech.
Don't you think the prospect of, which we've been doing for years, of having an answering speech to the State of the Union, which always seems to be overwhelmed by the State of the Union because it doesn't have the pomp and circumstance and very tough to remember any particular answering speech, whether it was by a Democrat or a Republican, that's been particularly effective. Are you surprised at all about the selection of Senator Katie Britt, who is not exactly a household word, that was a timely and appropriate selection for the Republican leadership?
You know, I think you're right. It's obviously less great than being the vice president of the United States. But as somebody described that as a warm bucket of spit, I kind of think of giving the other side's response exactly as you described it. I think that they try to pick people who they are hoping will have a higher profile, who they're hoping they're going to boost. I cannot, as you just said, I can only think of one response, and that was many years ago when Fred Thompson did the response. And he was a TV actor, famous, really good at the spoken word, so he did a marvelous job. Everybody else has been so unmemorable, I can't even conceive of the idea that this is going to boost someone's career.
Right. And it didn't really work that way because of a gulp of water for Marco Rubio, who was trying to promote his own presidential. But speaking of awful, I want to give you a chance to respond to a pre-buttle from President Trump, where he had some harsh words, and not surprising, about the Biden administration. Listen.
By crooked Joe Biden and the people that surround him, and they are radical left Marxists and fascists and communists and socialists. We have people running our country, the likes of which we have never seen before. He and the communists and his party looted trillions of dollars from you and spent it on illegal aliens and the Green New Scam. But
does that sound like the kind of rhetoric that is going to bring us together?
No. I will only say one thing in Donald Trump's defense, and that is that he has never pretended to be a uniter. His inaugural speech when he was president didn't suggest that, whereas Joe Biden's did. That was always my big hope. You know, I had worked with Joe Biden for many years when I was working in the Senate, and I had hoped that he was going to be a uniter, a healer, and he hasn't been. And while he does not rise or lower himself, whatever you choose, to the kind of rhetoric that Donald Trump just used, I'm a little worried that he is going to tonight suggest that the Republicans are on the side of dictators like Putin. If he does that, he is going to be no different than what you just heard from DJT.
We will be continuing the conversation with Danielle Pletka. She has written a piece asking a very strong question. We don't tend to believe terrorists. We take them and whatever they say with a grain of salt. Why is it that nearly everybody has accepted the terrorist, the Hamas, estimates of the number of casualties in Gaza? Everybody takes their number of 30,000 people dead. There are reasons to question it. There's somebody else who's questioning it, too. Ralph Nader says there are 2 million people who have been killed in Gaza. Pardon me, 200,000 people who have been killed in Gaza so far. We will get to that and why it matters and more with Daniel Pletka of American Enterprise Institute coming up.
The Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, a few minutes more, speaking with Danielle Pletka, who is a distinguished senior fellow in foreign and defense policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute, AEI. One of her most recent pieces, just released this week, is under the heading, Don't Fall for Hamas's Numbers Game. And when you talk about the numbers game, you're talking about the numbers that are regularly discussed and actually promoted, numbers from the so-called health ministry of Hamas, numbers that say that some 30,000 Palestinians, they claim nearly all of them civilian, have been killed in the war in Gaza. What's wrong with accepting those numbers?
Let me quote none other than Joe Biden, who said he had, quote, no confidence in the number that the Palestinians are using. His spokesman, Admiral John Kirby, explained that when asked. He said, "We all know that the Gaza Ministry of Health is just a front for Hamas. It is run by Hamas, a terrorist organization. I've said it myself up here," Kirby continued. "We can't take anything coming out of Hamas, including the so-called Ministry of Health, at face value," unquote. I think they said exactly the right thing.
And the danger, of course, is that Hamas has every reason, every motivation to exaggerate the amount of killing that is occurring. What works to their advantage with that exaggeration?
So Hamas's goal, among Hamas's goals, let's say, obviously its main goal is the eradication of the state of Israel and an assault on the Jewish people in the Middle East. But in the interim, it hopes to delegitimize the existence of the state of Israel, something that it gets great help from, not simply from parts of the American left, but also, for example, from the government of South Africa, which brought Israel to the International Court of Justice based on some of these claims by Hamas. It is also hoping, because there's really no other source of numbers, they're sort of alone in this field, so they are hoping that their numbers will become de facto and even de jure the only ones, and they will be believed. They want to suggest that there has been an enormous amount, not simply of collateral damage, but of wanton damage. The problem is their stats suggest very often that no men are being killed. Now, I'm not sure how anybody can believe that's credible.
Right. And the point that, of course, the IDF makes, the Israel Defense Forces, is that most of the casualties that they consciously imposed were against fighters, were against people who were engaged in extraordinarily brutal combat with the Israeli forces. And I believe the estimate they use is that up to 12,000 terrorists have fallen in this conflict, which would mean that go ahead.
Oh, sorry. No, that's exactly right. Now, I mean, is it 12,000? Is it 12,300? Is it 12,014? We have no idea. But I'll say this, and I think it's something that people don't understand when they imagine to themselves what a war between Israel and Hamas looks like. Hamas is a terrorist organization. By definition, it flouts the laws of war. Military officers and soldiers are supposed to be, by law, international law, in uniform. These people not only are not in uniform, they are never in uniform. They surround themselves, and there's plenty of photographic evidence of this, they surround themselves with children in order to move from place to place. They use ambulances and hospitals as places not simply to store weapons, but also to keep hostages and to keep their own operational activities. So again, you know, the problem for all of us, even, you know, and no one wants to see women and children or innocent civilians, men as well, killed. The problem is that Hamas makes it extraordinarily difficult on purpose.
And you were talking before about how there are very few people who formally question that figure of 30,000 civilians who have perished needlessly in this war, etc. And, of course, the people who are demonstrating on behalf of Hamas and on behalf of from the river to the sea, all of Palestine should be free, etc., etc. Added to those voices was the voice of Ralph Nader, 90 years old now, and he's a four-time presidential candidate. He just published a piece, which I have responded to, and my response is posted on our website. It's at michaelmedved.com. It's also at Substack. He is claiming that it's not 30,000 people who have been killed, that actually Hamas and Israel are both lowballing that figure, and that the real figure is 200,000 who have been killed. Can you think of any reason, Daniel Pletka, that Hamas would want to lowball a figure of casualties in the war that they started?
So I guess if you see things from the warped perspective that apparently Ralph Nader has, you think to yourself, oh, well, Hamas governs Gaza. And so, of course, as any government would, they hope to minimize the number of casualties so that people aren't angry with them. That's ridiculous. That's not what Hamas does. That's not who they are. And on top of everything else, we have several proven instances, even the New York Times agrees with, where Hamas has given numbers that are either deaths caused by Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad within Gaza, or simply bear no relationship to reality. So I don't know. I mean, you know, look, Ralph Nader has a long history of being a how can I say this nicely, a crank.
I thought you were going to say crackpot, but go ahead.
Well, I think people can pick and choose between those two words, and they're equally accurate. But the notion that 10%, right, we're talking about 10% of the population of Gaza here, and that a population that Israel has very scrupulously tried to move out of civilian combat areas, the notion that somehow 10% of Gazans have been killed over the last 3 or 4 months is simply unhinged.
Last question. Kamala Harris speaking in Selma, Alabama on the commemoration of Bloody Sunday and the civil rights cause, passionately and repeatedly called for an immediate ceasefire. Was that helpful?
It was weird, and it was a game. And I'll tell you why I think it was a game. I think the Biden administration is having a very hard time speaking to their pro-Hamas far left, which is demanding a ceasefire now. In other words, demanding Israeli capitulation without the return of the hostages, without the destruction of Hamas, which is not going to happen. I think what they were trying to do was get Kamala Harris out there, placate those people, and then when the 80% of Americans and their representatives who support Israel in this conflict protested, said, no, you don't understand what she meant. She meant that Hamas is standing in the way of a ceasefire and a return of the hostages, and she was talking to them. These kinds of games are beneath the White House, and they're dishonest.
And you don't expect that there will be any echo of that tonight from the President of the United States?
I suspect that the President is going to call for an immediate ceasefire, but he's going to try to suggest that it is on Hamas to accept the terms of ceasefire. And of course, the Israelis and Hamas have been negotiating for a temporary ceasefire, which Israel has already accepted and Hamas refuses to accept because they don't wish to return all the hostages. So, you know, again, all of the weight for a temporary ceasefire is on Hamas. So I expect him to play the same kinds of games again in the hopes of fooling some of the people some of the time.
Daniel Pletka, who is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, her most recent pieces, Don't Fall for Hamas's Numbers Game, and also About the State of the Union, which we all eagerly await tonight, posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. It's terrific and informative to speak to you, Danielle, and we look forward to the next time. Coming up on the Medved Show, what about that question? Are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Question that neither Biden, well, nor Trump is really prepared to answer in this greatest nation on God's green earth.